This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Jay Hanselman, filling in for Mark Haney. The water crisis in Flint, Michigan last year raised awareness of the severe health damage caused by the lack of clean water. And while most communities in the United States take clean water for granted, according to a government Indian Health Service report, about 7.5% of Native American and Alaska Native homes did not have safe drinking water or basic sanitation as of 2013. Joining us to discuss the continuing struggle for clean water around the world and here in the U.S. are University of Cincinnati Associate Professor and Court Court Archaeological Research Facility Curator, Dr. Ken Tankersley, and we'll give you your full promotion now to full professor, and UNESCO Co-Chair of Water Access and Sustainability, UC Professor and Chair of Taft Faculty, Dr. Adrian Parr. Parr co-produced the documentary, The Intimate Realities of Water, and is currently working on a new documentary, Thirsty and Drowning, that focuses on the water struggles of Native Americans. You can join our conversation. Our phone number is 513-419-7100 or email us at talk@wvxu.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter, again, 513-419-7100. And welcome. Thank you both for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Dr. Parr, you've been on before, so I'm going to start with Dr. Tankersley. Tell us about what your work is. Tell us what you do.
First and foremost, I'm an anthropologist, but I also am heavily involved in geochemistry. In addition to that, I'm an enrolled tribal member of the Piqua, an Algonquian-speaking tribe. I'm an enrolled voting member. I'm very active. I'm a member of the Elders Council as well, and I've been a longstanding activists in terms of Native American rights.
And Dr. Parr, we mentioned in the intro there that you co-produced the documentary, The Intimate Realities of Water, which has won several awards, you were telling me. And you were on the show about a year ago talking about the documentary. Just refresh our memory about what it was about and what prompted you to create that documentary.
So the documentary is the result of several years of field trips in my capacity as UNESCO water chair in the slums of Nairobi, two slums in particular, the Dagoretti slum and the Kibera slum. And the documentary follows the lives of four women very, very closely, hence the intimate realities of water, and examines the water challenges that they face on a daily basis, access to safe potable water and access, meaning also, you know, the cost of water, because the price of water in the slums is much higher than what, say, the average person in the developed world has to pay. And I wanted to make a movie that would also be able to be shown within the circles of the United Nations and hopefully influence policymakers. So that was really the impetus behind creating the film. And I was very lucky to be able to work very closely with John and Sean Hughes. Sean Hughes is the co-director with myself, and John is the director of photography. And we're now still working together in the capacity of, you know, making this new film, Thirsty and Drowning.
And talk about the transition there. Before we went on the air, you were talking about that there was a reason that you're bringing from the developing world to the developed world with this new film.
Yeah. So the reasoning behind making the first film was really to humanize statistics. Right. So there are a lot of big numbers out there that we look at when we think of World Water Day and what it is we're trying to sort of promote and celebrate and raise awareness around. You know, one of them is that there are 663 million people in the world currently who don't have access to safe drinking water. That's one big statistic. The other one is that 38% of health facilities, say, in the developing world actually don't have clean water, which costs lives. And 11% of, you know, global maternity mortality rates is the result of sepsis in the developing world, which can be prevented by access to clean water. So these are sort of big numbers, but how do they sort of translate when you get up close into people's lives? So that was the first impetus around the first film. And so, you know, the film is shot in a low-income country, Nairobi, and in a city, in a very low-income part of the city, i.e. in the slums. And with the Flint crisis, it really struck me that a lot of the time with these large numbers, we lose sight of the fact that just because we're living in a high-income country doesn't mean that our own communities here aren't suffering from similar water challenges to those in living in low-income countries. And Flint certainly, I think, magnified that issue. And the more I looked at these issues, the more I kept landing back in the reservations of Native Americans. And it was there that I decided to make a film about America's challenges vis-a-vis access and equitable access to safe drinking water. And hence this film is exploring up close and intimate the situation of a variety of Native American tribes around the country. One of them is down in southeast Louisiana. They're actually our first climate refugees. So their water situation is the result of sea level rise and them having lost 98% of their land. And they've won a big $48 million HUD grant, federal grant, to be relocated. But other places that we're going to include Standing Rock, Pine Ridge, and Ken can talk about that a little bit more, where those communities are suffering from issues pertaining to water contamination or potential water contamination as the result of the Dakota Access Pipeline going through their drinking water supplies in North Dakota.
Dr. Tankersley, we heard a lot about the Dakota Access Pipeline, mm-hmm. and the concern there, I guess, is that there is a chance that even though it's under the river, that it still has the potential to pollute the water supply.
Well, you have to understand that petroleum leaks everywhere. It's almost impossible to contain. So all pipelines all over the world are actively leaking. And when you look at the content of petroleum,
the number that are leaking?
All of them.
Well, you know, if you look at the Pipeline and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration survey, they've actually documented over 2,000 significant accidents since 1995, and there's been an average of 120 accidents annually from the period 2013 to 2015. And that's a documented, series of numbers there.
Yeah. And so, yeah, that's documented. It doesn't even include the undocumented leaks or the ones we don't know about. And you have to understand that petroleum contains volatile hydrocarbons, including benzene. One of the worst carcinogens in terms of volatile hydrocarbons is benzene. And getting that into the water supply means people are drinking it. And when you look at, for example, at Pine Ridge, 60% of the homes at Pine Ridge currently have right now, in addition to exposures of arsenic, they also have experiencing carcinogens, and in addition to that, radionucleotides, which is in addition to benzene, another carcinogenic exposure. And what it's not just cancer, but it also leads to diabetes, heart disease, and kidney failure. On top of that, it carries trace element contents of zinc, magnesium, lead, and iron. And these are strongly associated with chronic depression. And when you look at the Pine Ridge Reservation, it has a high incidence of chronic depression. And most people attribute it to social issues such as alcoholism, drug abuse, family abuse. But in reality, you throw on top of that the chemical origins on top of it, it's almost a hopeless situation.
And what's interesting with the Standing Rock community, and as you pointed out, the pipeline is to go under the Missouri River, which is half a mile upstream from where their water source is. And the potential leak of that pipeline would impact 28 tribes. But what's also interesting in that narrative is that the pipeline was actually originally meant to go through Mandan and Bismarck. The majority of that population is a white population, and they came out against the pipeline going through their area because they realized that the health implications of that, and the pipeline was diverted to go through areas which would be, you know, which would impact the Sioux tribe as opposed to the white community. So there's an instance there too of blatant sort of discrimination against the Native American communities that I find, deeply disturbing. Not to mention that, you know, the Army Corps of Engineers didn't conduct a full environmental impact assessment of that area. So not only are there also environmental impacts that we need to take into consideration, there are also cultural impacts. So it's in direct violation of the Historic Preservation Act, for example, because these are also areas that, you know, are important burial and sacred sites for the Sioux tribe. So there's a whole series of violations that are underway around the Dakota Access Pipeline story.
These places that you're talking about, is this the water for drinking, is it from wells or is it surface water that's being treated?
It's both. It's both. It's reservation-wide contamination. That's what's so bad about it. Whether or not you're collecting water from the ground, from natural aquifers, or in terms of a community-wide water system, they're all going to be contaminated. That's the tragedy of it. And from the perspective of Native Americans, most people understand genocide, the mass killing of Native Americans during European colonization. In the 1950s and 1960s, we saw ethnocide, essentially removing their actual history. And now, in 2017, we're seeing ecocide. So in many ways, this is, in fact, a gross human rights violation.
And are there, what about processing? I mean, we're familiar here in Cincinnati, it's been nationally recognized as some of the first for the best water treatment in the world with granular activated carbon. And I think we now have ultraviolet light for some disinfection. What kind of treatment facilities and processing facilities are we talking about in these Native lands, Native American lands?
Very, very few. And think about, would you drink essentially water that has been processed from waste that contains volatile carcinogenic hydrocarbons? I wouldn't want to. I'm a cancer survivor. So when you look at things like cancer and heart disease, I've experienced it. But drinking water from that, in addition to cancer and heart disease, we also have kidney failure as well. So imagine an aging population drinking this water. So at the same time, water is one of the most precious it is the most precious resource on the planet. A lot of people don't realize here in Cincinnati, we're considering converting our sewage treatment plants into drinking facilities.
Now, that's the first I've heard that. I'll admit that.
So, but then add the toxicity. I mean, in addition to zinc, manganese, lead, iron, arsenic that are in, you know, after the water has been processed, it's beyond the levels of what's considered the maximum contaminant level. And according to the EPA, it's considered not fit for human consumption. That's after it's been processed.
The water you're talking about, these lands, could that be processed here in Cincinnati?
No.
So you couldn't even process it with the world-class technology?
There are some waters in terms of if you want to, at a basic level, if water that's just flowing in a stream, if you want to remove things like cryptosporidia, which is will cause stomach ailments, gastrointestinal tract function, you can use a coffee filter. So in terms of biological contaminants, no problem. We can deal with that. There's both filtration and chemical systems. But how do you get rid of carcinogenic, or even the worst part is radionucleotides? How do you get rid of radioactive waste in water?
And the world has so few freshwater resources, really. Like, there's only 2.5% of the world's water is actually freshwater. Most of it's saline water. And the majority of that is caught in the ice caps and underground. So once we start sort of contaminating our surface water resources in this way, I think we're heading down a really dangerous track. We need to sort of be more mindful, not just in terms of water conservation around how much water we use, but the ways in which water gets downgraded at the same time.
Does the Federal Clean Water Act apply to Native American lands, or would it even make a difference?
Not only that, the National Environmental Policy Act applies. So in addition to Section 106 of the National Historic Preservation Act and the National Environmental Policy Act, the Army Corps of Engineers ignored both. They're looking for the current administration to deregulate these laws, and they're anticipating, well, why are we going to get prosecuted for laws that will probably be removed from the books? So they've completely ignored that. And in addition to that, there's an act of 1976, the Resource Conservation and Recovery Act, which allows the dumping of toxic waste on American Indian reservations.
Which is in complete contradistinction to actually a 1908 Supreme Court ruling that stated that when reservations were established, that the water for those people had to be guaranteed by the government. That was the Winters versus the United States court case that went up to the Supreme Court. So there's a massive sort of contradictions here, and a really basically it's not a level playing field in many ways.
What's the solutions then? Is it caught up in bureaucracy? Is there not enough money? How do you fix it? What do you tell these people that have these issues? What do they do?
Well, one of the first things is it would help if we didn't have an executive order that was signed to allow the Dakota Access Pipeline and the Keystone Pipeline to continue. And unfortunately, our current president was incorrect when he said it would create 28,000 jobs. What he failed to also add to that was only 35 to 40 of those jobs would be permanent jobs. So I think, you know, the payoff is extremely small when you're talking about a precious environmental resource like this. Also, what would help is if the Environmental Protection Agency was given more funding to be able to enforce these laws and to do follow-up testing in these areas to ensure that the water is safe. Currently, we're in a situation where funding to the Environmental Protection Authority is being rolled back. And if anything, there's a suggestion on the table to eliminate it completely by December 2018. So I think there are certainly legal mechanisms in place that can be used, and we can use the severe hand of policy, but we also need governments in place that are going to respect those policies and those laws, to help protect our citizens, that the overall health and well-being of all the citizens and all people who live in the United States and around the world.
I'll give you the final word in about 30 seconds, your take on solutions.
I'd like to quote John Hollowhorn, an Oglala Lakota, who saw this coming in 1932. He said, "Someday the earth will weep. She will beg for her life. She will cry with tears of blood. You will make a choice if you will help her or let her die. And when she dies, you too will die."
And just real quickly, you're working on this new film. You filmed some stuff. When can it be expected to be released?
That won't happen until next year, but if people are wanting to see the intimate realities of water, they can join us tomorrow night at the Esquire at 7 p.m.
We've been talking about the continuing struggle for clean water around the world and here in the U.S. My guests were University of Cincinnati professor and Cord Archaeological Research Facility curator Dr. Ken Tankersley and UNESCO co-chair of water access and sustainability, UC professor and chair of TAF faculty, Dr. Adrian Parr. Thank you both for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Archives of our programs are available on our website, wvxu.org. Today's program was produced by Pete Reitmeier. The technical director was Josh Elstro. I'm Jay Hanselman. Thanks for listening to 91.7 WVXU.